Blog Talk Radio.
Can anybody out there hear my voice? Does anybody out there really care for a missing child?
Good evening, everyone. You are listening to Voices for Justice tonight, November 10th, 2010. I'm your host, Michelle Bart, and tonight we are so honored to have Seattle attorney Ann Bremner on the show, and in a few minutes, Ann will be taking your calls. The call-in number is 347-838-8622. The chat room is open. Log on to Blog Talk Radio / Helping Heroes and click chat. Known for covering the child molestation charges against Michael Jackson, Ann Bremner is a well-known Seattle trial attorney and is well-known also for defending Amanda Knox, an American student accused of killing her roommate, a British.
One kind soul to look my way. Maybe you would recognize me. From the pictures where they say I'm a missing child. Could be your son, could be your friend, could be your daughter. No way to go, I'll be bound to love forever. Won't somebody please,
won't somebody please
come look for me. Like I vanished in thin air. All the places they can hide me, miracles that find me. Do I really have a prayer? I am sending out this message. Won't you pass these words along?
Are you with us?
Yeah.
I am so very sorry. It appears that Blog Talk Radio kicked the host off. So I apologize.
Oh.
I'm not sure how far I got in your introduction, but I do apologize to the listeners and especially you. So welcome to Voices for Justice again. We're glad you're with us.
Thanks for having me. I'm honored.
No problem. You know, before we get going into Susan's case and all, this past week on Monday, we learned that Amanda was indicted for slander, of all things.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we start with the Amanda Knox case? I know that the last time you were on back last year, we had a lot of listeners that were very interested in Amanda Knox's case. And for those of you listening tonight, you can also log on to friendsofamanda.org or annbremner.com to learn more about the cases that Ann works on. But let's start there. What happened this week?
Well, she was basically, they ordered that she stand trial for criminal slander defamation based upon her claim that she was struck in the head during hours and hours and hours of interrogation without a lawyer and without a certified interpreter, where she spoke no Italian, you know, back when she was originally arrested. It's stunning on many fronts, especially because here in the United States, we have First Amendment rights. They don't in Italy, and they criminalize what they deem to be slander and defamation. And so her defense became yet another crime.
What have you had contact with her parents and her family? I know that we had her aunt on the show last year. How are they doing?
Well, I think the family is incredibly great about updating all that are concerned. And also, there's phone calls with Amanda with the family from their home in West Seattle. They rotate and go to Italy. There's always a family member there, you know, monthly, sometimes for a number of months, but never a lack of a presence by the family in Italy. But it gets just more and more frustrating as time goes on, because she's facing now 26 years in prison and now this additional charge. And don't forget, her parents are facing the same charges for repeating what she said. And so it seems like this endless Kafkaesque you know, tunnel that she's in, that she may never emerge from intact, or won't until she's well into her 50s or 60s.
I think when we spoke last in regards to Amanda's case, I want to say it was Dr. Kobolinski, when we talked about
yes.
the forensic evidence and lack of, that there was no forensic evidence to prosecute here in the United States. If this crime had taken place here, she would have never been able to
yes.
get prosecuted.
So yeah, and that's stunning.
So why is it so different over in Italy, and how can they prosecute somebody when there's no evidence to show that she had any part to doing, just because character assassination, which we've seen on like the Casey Anthony case, etc. You know, it's almost like we need to teach folks, if there's going to be something that happens in your life, just remember, always act stern and sane.
Yeah,
but,
that's right. No smiling, no going out for pizza, no going shopping to make sure you like have underwear. I mean, those are the things that got her indicted that
exactly.
they felt were inappropriate. And the other part of it was that she's, you know, somebody that was not, as you said, as grim or stern as some of the UK friends of Meredith. And the other part is they don't have the same standards there on forensic evidence and admissibility. And there's no hair, there's no fiber, there's no fingerprint, there's no blood. There's no forensic evidence whatsoever to tie Amanda Knox to this crime. And even the knife they said that was used supposedly in the crime didn't match the wounds. And they had DNA on a handle from Amanda Knox, and it was a cookie knife. But the pretrial hearing took a year. Here it would take 2 hours before you're charged. It took a year there. It was secret. But all kinds of salacious false leaks came out throughout that year. And the demonizing of Amanda Knox was just extraordinary. And it really seemed that when we got involved, we were trying to turn around a super tanker of misinformation about someone who'd been convicted in the press based upon just kind of a broad brush of she's a promiscuous American girl, she was laughing, she was inappropriate, she went shopping for lingerie, et cetera, when there was no evidence.
What about, do you feel that our justice system here has, or not justice system, but do you feel that any of our leaders in Washington, D.C., could help to have a voice for her and have not yet?
Absolutely. You know, Donald Trump came out and said, boycott Italy, Amanda Knox is innocent. Yeah, he came out, he's a powerful voice. Marie Cantwell, one of our senators in Washington, came out and condemned the conviction and said she should be speaking with Hillary Clinton. But I think it's the kind of case where we've got to have intervention from our leaders, because their system has convicted her. Their system and standards on evidence has convicted her. And I don't see that there's going to be a real significant change over time. She could have a reduction of a sentence, but would she be exonerated in Italy? I think that's something that's, you know, hope springs eternal, but the likelihood isn't really there. So we need to see the United States stand up and then take action.
Now, the prosecutor for in Italy, didn't he have his own issues with the law and things of that nature, where a slanderous suit, was it against him or was it against the police that interrogated her?
Well, Mignini was and is the prosecutor. He was indicted and convicted for abuse of office for his techniques in conducting interrogations, eavesdropping devices, and things of that nature. So he's got that conviction, which is on appeal. And then the police officers that dealt with Amanda Knox, and he was one of the individuals that interrogated her. But these officers who were accused of assault basically brought this defamation case. And ironically, the lawyer that represents them is the lawyer that represents the victim's family in the Amanda Knox case.
I guess I just can't understand how in the world, you know, this man who, you know, has his own issues, she could be prosecuted again for slander on him, and yet, again, there's still no proof that, you know, that there was, I don't know, I'm just lost on that case, because, you know, a lot of people in America believe that she's innocent, a lot of people around the world, but then you get just as many people believing that she's done this crime, and it's like, how can you prosecute somebody in today's day and age without the DNA, without the evidence, and think that this young lady could have gotten out of that room and cleaned up a stitch of hair off of her head from that room. I just can't understand.
Everything. Right. And
fingerprints,
add to that,
footmarks, anything.
And that's an excellent point. And add to that, that the claim was that this is a ritualistic sex flame. So that they supposedly were three involved in some kind of a sex attack on Meredith. So wouldn't you think there'd be evidence with that kind of a claim struggle and that kind of activity in a bedroom, just in addition to committing a homicide? And there's nothing.
Not a stitch.
Not a stitch.
And so that's why it's just ludicrous about the whole situation. Now, is this the end for her having to go back to court for any other reason other than appeals?
Well, she's going to have an actual trial on the defamation. So it'll go through the same process that she did in her homicide case. And then the appeals are kind of two-part. And one is kind of a de novo review where evidence is heard again, like another trial. And then there's a review that generally would deal with the sentence itself.
So
she's going
to
spend a lot more time in court.
The same trial, a recount of the trial, will she have the same people that she's speaking and having to testify to?
It appears that way. And I think the most important thing now is that there was a chance for the court to and the jury to order an independent review of the forensic evidence. That's allowed in Italy. They decided not to do that. Maybe this time that'll occur.
Now, is evidence from that the first trial allowed in for the second?
It's generally called de novo, so you're just starting all over again. But
okay.
I would imagine that if you wanted to have some testimony repeated or things like that, if there's agreement of the parties, you could do that. But there's some advantages to the Italian system. One of them is on their appeals, you can hear it all over again, all anew. In the U.S., it's just generally errors of law that are reviewed or sufficiency of the evidence. So we're very restrictive. They're very expansive.
Wow. It's
I know.
Just
so there's some
good things. To go through all of this again.
Well, it's a shame, and I think if your listeners have seen pictures of her recently or video of her on the web or on television, she's changed so much. You know, you can just see that here's a young girl from Seattle that set out with her whole life ahead of her who's just gone into a nightmare that's unending, and it shows.
Do you have any advice for anybody listening or that may download this podcast later? for traveling or thinking that, you know, in this particular case, Italy is a safe place to go?
Well, you know, I hear from so many people about this case. This is every parent's nightmare, that you send your child off like Amanda Knox was working four jobs at the University of Washington and wanted to go to Italy to study Italian. The parents never thought this could ever happen. And when you look at what's happened to her, she could have just gotten on an airplane as soon as the crime was discovered. But she stuck around and helped with respect to the investigation, any information she could impart to help. And so I think, you know, we've even called this the Menini Express, like the Midnight Express. I mean, it's a nightmare. When you go to another country, you're at their mercy, and they're a sovereign nation. And so whatever they, you know, dictate, you got to live by. And Italy has an old system. It's Roman law, older than our common law, of course, and very respected. And so the fact of the matter is, you're stuck. And so anytime, you know, you've got children traveling or you're traveling, you've got to remember that if you're not in the United States, you just don't have the same rights that we enjoy here and that we take for granted.
With that prosecutor, and you say his name a lot better than I can, and out of respect to Amanda, I don't even think there's an appropriate name for this guy, but wasn't one of the cases similar to Amanda's that he actually staged or fixed?
Well, there's a book called The Monster of Florence. It's written by Doug Preston, and there were allegations against Menini in that case of inappropriate prosecution, coercive questioning, and he made a claim basically of Satanism in these unsolved homicides that was eerily similar to what was seen in the Amanda Knox case. It turned out that he was absolutely wrong, and he tried to imprison an investigator in that case, a man named Mario Spizzi. And so if you talk to Doug Preston or others that have read The Monster of Florence, they say, oh, my God, this is just that fiction, but it wasn't fiction. It was actually a true case, nonfiction, excuse me, became the Amanda Knox case with the same person involved. And he's playing out the same thing. He even listened to a clairvoyant who has since died that would tell him various things that would be in the case. And that would dictate what he would do in his prosecution.
And yet none of that can come into consideration when the trials go in front of their panel, their jury. Correct?
No, I think correct. And I think the thing is, you know, this clairvoyant, or she was like a medium, and she talked to like a dead priest who would tell her things that she would impart to Menini. And it's been explained to us and the friends of Amanda Knox that it's not uncommon for prosecutors or other officials to be indicted in Italy. But it would seem to all of us that if it's as high-profile a case as the Amanda Knox case, which has worldwide attention, that you wouldn't want to have someone involved in the case that had this conviction, especially where it was for things similar to what's being alleged as wrongdoing in the Amanda Knox case by him.
Wow.
It's a stunning case, but then there's also criticism of us, you know, from around the world saying you've got to respect Italy. And we do. They're a sovereign nation. But this was a case that was tried by this particular prosecutor who had these issues, and it was a case that was tried in the media. And the jurors were able to read the media, talk about the media, and talk to each other during the trial before they reached their verdict. And that would never happen here.
When they came to the house, when they came upon the murder and all of that, now, was Amanda intoxicated or on drugs at that time?
No. She had smoked hashish the night before.
She smoked what? Okay. So
but she was not at the time that she spoke with these folks, with the interrogators, although she was definitely, for what she said to them, confused when they started telling her things like, you were there, you did it. And then they said things to her like, okay, why don't you imagine you were there and then tell us what you would have done. She said, I would have covered my ears. You know, I would imagine they were screaming. They reported it as Amanda Knox said she was there, covered her ears when she heard Meredith screaming.
So they twisted everything around in
That's
her
right.
interrogation. So
right.
for our listeners, and actually for me too, What is that substance? Is that an herb or something? I've
hashish?
Never heard of it.
Uh-huh. Oh, it's like marijuana.
It's like marijuana. So one would think that somebody that's high on pot would do a heinous crime like that.
Right.
One would have to black out and not realize that they've done that crime. I mean, I would think it would be LSD or something a lot stronger than marijuana that could put somebody in a place like Amanda Knox. There's many people I could put in that position. But Amanda Knox, straight-laced, four jobs, student, liked her roommate, you know, was in a new relationship, etc. They did not appear as if they just did this heinous crime when you saw the cameras on them outside.
Well, and that, exactly. And Amanda is, I mean, a lot of her friends and family say, and you know, that she's hippie-ish, she's naive, a little bohemian, trusting. So you see her with her boyfriend of 2 weeks, Raffaele Switchito, and she's, they're trying to comfort each other. That's what you see that film over and over again of the two of them embracing outside the house. And then she went to shop for lingerie and, well, for underwear. And the clerk supposedly told reporters that the two were speaking, you know, sexually. Well, this clerk didn't speak any English. And they were speaking in English. And then, of course, she went out for dinner that night because the house was a crime scene. And they had pizza. So that's, you know, she was just naive and she wanted to help and she wanted to help the authorities. She could have left. She had, her mom had a relative in Europe she could have stayed with. Or she could have just flown home to Seattle. But she didn't. She had nothing to hide.
Amazing. Just amazing. If you have any questions for Anne, the call-in number is 347-838-8622. Right now we're speaking with Anne Bremner in regards to the Amanda Knox case, the American student from Seattle that went over to Italy and has been prosecuted not once, but now ridiculously twice. And it is ridiculous. I don't know. How is it to be a defense attorney and not be able to bring justice when you know it's due?
Well, and I work with the Friends of Amanda Knox, and I can't practice in Italy, but it's so maddening to watch this thing unfold where, you know, you hear these accounts, you know, around the world. You hear it, you know, on the mainstream, early on, the mainstream U.S. press, the misinformation about this case, saying that the knife, you know, matched the wounds, that it matched Amanda, that it had Meredith's blood on the tip, which it didn't, you know, and to hear these things repeated over and over again, like if you repeat them enough, they'll be true. And you feel powerless because there's nothing you can do. That's all happening in a courtroom in Italy, and it's being tried in the press. It was tried in the press in the UK and in Italy, and it was tabloid-ish always. And you have to wonder, what about Raphael? How come he wasn't demonized? But Amanda was. You know, why is she the vixen in the case, the focal point of the ire of people that look at this case negatively? And when you
did she get more time than both of those other, both her boyfriend and the other guy?
She did.
Well, and
she did.
What do you make of that?
Well, I think that she's been made to be the focal point of this case, and the prosecutor's done that. I mean, he's attacked her constantly. Raffaele's like an also-ran. And Rudy Gadet, who was found guilty, who was the sole perpetrator, had a much lesser sentence and then got cut in half. And so you have to look at that and wonder, you know, how often do you hear ritualistic slayings by three people when those people didn't even know the victim? Where it's a woman that's never heretofore done anything wrong in her life, who went over as an exchange student, as Nancy Grace would say, scrubbed in sunshine. I mean, it's just, none of it makes any sense. But yet she was the one that was
really
attacked.
Yeah, and like you said, she could have gotten on a plane, but so could the other two. I would assume that they had passports. They could have left with nobody wondering why they're leaving right now until all of a sudden, you know, her roommate's body is found. and then an investigation start, and then you would definitely know if Amanda had come back to the U.S., not only would Italy be against us, but our own, you know, leaders in Washington, D.C. would most likely send her back to Italy, I would assume.
Well, although that on the quantum of evidence in this case, the true lack of evidence, it could well have been that on an extradition, you know, with Italy trying to request her presence out of the U.S., a U.S. check might find there's not enough to send her back. They actually haven't come an evidentiary hearing extradition. And so they'll say, you know, is there, you know, is this a crime in the U.S. and is there sufficient evidence for it to be extraditable? Now, that's just me speaking as a lawyer. It's pretty technical, you know, and I've defended an extradition where I won that issue, where there just wasn't enough. So that's conceivable. But the fact is it's an international relations issue, and we don't want to fight with Italy. If we have a murderer on our grounds, and it needs to go back there. You should also know that Rudy Gadea fled and had to be extradited. They actually brought him back from Germany.
Really?
Yeah, well, he waived the extradition, but he fled to Germany, and he came back to Italy.
Now, will he have any part to the slander trial?
No. Because
okay,
he wasn't
so he
present.
Won't be prosecuting her in that.
Oh, well, I'll tell you what, I don't know yet. Anything could happen with this prosecutor. He could be involved in that prosecution.
Oh, that's true. Any last thoughts on Sarah, on Amanda's case, or what are friends of Amanda doing? Anything that the listeners can help you with or participate? Any events coming up?
We've got a number of fundraisers coming up, and those are on our website. We also have experts here in the United States, including Steve Moore, ex-FBI, who've gone through and done excellent analyses of the forensics or the lack of forensics. There's also the Defense Fund to help in her legal costs as she battles this out in Italy. And also attempts to reach out to Hillary Clinton and others that can have a voice for her and make a difference. So I think all your listeners need to think that, you know, injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. This is our hometown case in Seattle, but look what's happening to an American abroad who's an innocent abroad. It could happen to anyone's child. It could happen to anybody, and so it's important to get in and help.
Well, we see a lot of kidnappings also that take place, like to Brazil. We have, I think 82 children right now from America over there that can't be brought back. We just saw the three boys from San Bernardino, California, that were returned to their mothers. That had left the country. It takes a lot of time and a lot of money. And especially in this particular case, the defense fund, who is her attorney at this time?
Well, Ted Simon in the U.S., he's from Philadelphia. He's a State Department international law expert, which is what she needs. Because post-conviction, it really is dealing with the whole issue of international relations.
Definitely, and especially nowadays, it's, you know, we are trying to make peace around the world, but obviously with cases like this, and I'm sure Amanda's isn't the only one at this time, it's just the one that we're all hearing about.
Yeah, and like, she has Italian counsel, you know, in Italy, but the question in the U.S. is simply, you know, what can be done for her here, and that's State Department, interfacing with folks here that could help.
Definitely. So if anyone's listening and you're trying to figure out what you can do, go to www.friendsofamanda.org.
And also AmandaDefenseFund.org. You mentioned that earlier, Michelle.
Oh, okay.
That's a good one.
Say that website again.
www.AmandaDefenseFund.org.
We have a question, or actually I think it's just a comment, but somebody in the chat room wanting to know who actually lets their child go to a strange city for, well, it wasn't spring. It wasn't spring break, was it? She
no.
was going off to college, correct?
That's right. She was a junior at the University of Washington, to be a junior. So she was spending a year abroad, which you see in many university programs, that students spend a year abroad to study, you know, a certain aspect of that country or, you know, certain subject matters. And so she was to have been at this international university in Perugia for one full year.
So I hope that answered the question of the individual.
Well, and when, you know, I think when we look at Natalie Holloway, that was a case, you know, the class trip to Aruba where she disappeared.
Brittany. Also, you know, there's a lot of kids that go missing on spring break, and there's a lot of kids that go missing each day. On average, 21 to 2,200 children are reported missing each and every day. And many, unfortunately, when we're talking about teenagers, when a teen goes missing, law enforcement, I'll cover my butt, always tends to possibly think that they're a runaway. You know, we saw that in the Drexel case. We've seen that in the Holloway case. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then when it's evident that they're not a runaway, then we're just so far behind trying to find out what really happened, unfortunately.
And that's the thing that, you know, in cases like this, or Natalie Holloway, we'll never know what happened to her. But, you know, when you've got, you know, parents that are acting in good faith, thinking they're chaperones or they're going to be on a trip that's okay or whatever. It's just, you just got to watch your kids so closely in this world today. You know,
you really do. Scary. It's a mean world.
It's a mean, mean world.
Definitely.
And I think about when I was a kid, we could go out and play until, you know, we got called home dark to go have dinner. We could go wherever as little kids. And that's not the case anymore.
Yeah, we used to stay out to 10 or 11 playing, you know, and then we knew it was dark. Okay, time to go home. And it wasn't an issue as much as it is today. But then again, we all, you know, you have the girls that are dreaming of marrying their sweetheart and having children. And then they, too, go missing, such as in Susan's case. And I'll tell you, the one thing that I think it was Inside Edition, Deborah Norville did in a recap of things on that case recently.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that they were missing was that, yes, Josh Powell packed up and moved his kids soon after the search efforts and moved here to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
But the catcher is, he's, what, 2-3 blocks away from Susan's parents,
mm-hmm.
and her parents don't even get to see the children. So I think that power trip is a continuation, and their comments recently made all of those I know that saw it sick to their stomach, chewed up like
mm-hmm.
hamburger meat when she returned.
That was stunning. And I'm representing Chuck and Judy now just to help them, you know, through some of this and things to do. But I almost thought that was projectionism, that Josh would be thinking Josh is going to get chewed up by hamburger with all the things he's saying, you know, and that he must feel like the telltale heart that at some point he's going to be, you know, exposed in terms of taking the kids and Susan camping in sub-freezing weather at midnight. You know,
if
not showing up for work, he forgot. If he did that, you know, that, but not showing up for work that Monday because he forgot, you know, that he's,
it was,
you know,
Monday.
It's Monday. And then, you know, there's like the wet spot, looks like blood in the, you know, on the carpet. He says, oh, it's like juice. And then, oh, well, now he's saying she's sexually active and acting out and that she just doesn't want to come home because her parents were abusive. You know, and get her to be a saint.
Her parents were abusive, yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah. When they've been like, they've been doing everything and anything they can do find her, to find out where she is, to get justice. I mean, there's nobody like them. And yet for him to come out and say that was so demonic, you know, about Susan's parents. And then Susan, of course, you know, that, you know, she wants to go live her own life. I mean, she was the breadwinner. She supported him.
Right.
You know, she was the responsible one.
And it was very sad that, you know, that he continues to seem like he's the one in control. You know,
right.
I had the opportunity of meeting Chuck and Judy Cox at the Lindsay Baum 1 year. And I hate calling it an anniversary, but the year to the day that she had been missing from McCleary, Washington. And
oh, yeah.
I'll tell you, he and Judy are everything like they are when you watch Nancy Grace or Jane Velez. They are, it's heartbreaking to hear the story of really what was transpiring in that relationship between Susan and Josh leading up to her disappearance. And we had them on recently, Voices for Justice, and one thing I think listeners always need to hear is if you see something happening or you know something's happening, go with your gut and try to have a voice. We're all faced at one time or another seeing somebody in a unhealthy situation. But it's a real shame what happened to that lady. And I'm hoping she's okay, but you know, I think the police need to listen to her son. And
right.
You know, mom diving for jewels or looking for jewels, I think. No, as a defense attorney, do you take what children have to say seriously and put it towards a trial?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I remember that murder case. It was a police officer that killed his estranged girlfriend who was pregnant, and she had a little child,
yeah.
And he kept saying mommy was in the rug. You know, and that's how they found her. You know, that was a little one. Mommy's in the rug. You know, mommy's in the rug. And they, you know, that they found her body, and that's what she was in. And I think that I've dealt with 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds. I used to prosecute abuse cases involving children, homicide cases, sexual assault cases. And, of course, you've got competency issues of kids that are down in that age range. But you can get amazing things out of kids. You know, they'll tell you things. And you know, her 2 sons, I think, need to be interviewed far more at length. And Josh isn't being very cooperative in that regard, as I understand it, because, you know, they're going to be the key that unlocks a lot of the information. And Susan, of course, was under complete control by Josh, had no credit cards. You know, she had a whole diary of all the control that she was suffering under, which the prosecutors have. And she was, you know, fixing to get divorced, which was the ultimate betrayal, I'm sure, that may well have led to something horrible. But, you know, those kids, you know, they know things. That's why Josh may not want the grandparents involved either.
But if the children do know something in the beginning with interviewing them and they make a comment of that nature, are police able to continue to question children, or is there like a common rule there that you can't do it even if their attorney is in the room or an advocate?
Well, with a child victim, you know, you've got limits on how much time you can spend and what kind of leading questions you can use, if any, etc. And, you know, the problem is that if you re-interview children, you're going to end up potentially tainting their testimony or making it look to be suspect to a jury. The question of what statements would come into court, you know, these kids are too young to testify. They'd never be found competent to testify. But there could be important evidence that leads to discoveries in the investigation as to where she is.
Do you think that police are still reviewing or interviewing the children to some extent with the comments that he made?
I think that they're either have done it again, interviewed them at length with, you know, the experts, child advocates, and those that are experts interviewing children, or they'll do it shortly. I think he's been resistant, although that's just anecdotal. I don't know that directly.
Interesting.
But I'm trying to think how old those kids are now, though. They may be old enough to testify. But at any rate, it's the little ones, like I described, never. But then you get into competency issues of whether the test is, can the child tell the difference between a truth and a lie? And can they describe accurately what happened? And that can vary in age.
Well, we saw that also in the Haley Cummings case with Junior stating that a big, tall guy with a lot of dressed in all black and a hat and things like
that.
And yet we've never heard any more about that. And to be honest with you, the people that they keep saying are the people that were in the house that night, none of them look tall and full of black clothes. So, but I was, you know, I don't know, maybe that's a question for Kim Picazio, but Crystal had mentioned that that's what Junior had told police. So, you know, I was just curious. Sometimes it seems like police take children's comments seriously, and other times it seems like they brush it off a little bit.
I know, but you always have to think, you know, out of the mouths of babes come a lot of interesting things. And, you know, when they see something really traumatic, you know, they kind of repeat the same thing over and over again, you know, about what they saw. That whole idea that people say that, like in sex abuse cases, kids lie, I think the stats are pretty low. They're pretty honest, you know. I mean, they're kids.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to come in and say what happened to them. It's not like they're thinking about some game they played with their pals and making up little fantasy things, you know, that in their play world. I mean, if they're abused or they see a violent crime, you know, my experience has been, not only as a commentator but also as a prosecutor and defense lawyer, that they're very truthful. And I've represented sex victims in civil cases. Very truthful.
We have a question in the chat room. How does one have a voice when one sees an unhealthy relationship, especially if one doesn't know the couple too well?
That's a great question.
It is.
I think of Susan Powell's marriage, you know, was a recipe for disaster. And the more competent she was, the more that she was at risk. And I guess the way to have that kind of a voice, it's kind of like when someone says, you know, if your friend's, you know, having an affair, you know, your husband's having an affair, would you go tell him? And I'd say, you know, I would be saying yes. I mean, if someone's in an abusive relationship, would you step in and say, I think this is abusive? I'd say yes. You know, if there's a couple that you care about and there's somebody that looks to be at risk, you know, I guess you have to look at it and say, you know, how would I feel down the line if something really bad happened? You know, and I think, oh, I wish I would have said something. And even just to say, you know, I care about you or I know you and this is what I've observed, and to talk to someone about it. You can even report to law enforcement if there's something that could be potentially criminal on abuse. And you can do that anonymously.
They're following it up with a question, how do you do it without making this situation worse?
That's also an excellent question, because look at the O.J. Simpson case, you know, in terms of Nicole Simpson wanting to leave. That's a classic, far worse, arguably, and led to her death. I think with something like that is to have, the person that's a potential victim to be held in confidence, you know, the conversations you have. Because that way you're not going to make it any worse. The only way you make it worse is if the potential perpetrator gets their back up, feels like they're losing their control, you know, feels like they need to do something to exert control over somebody. And so I think it's, if you're acting out of love and caring and talking to someone, they may not see their situation the way you see it, looking from the outside in. They may well appreciate what you have to say and act accordingly.
How do loved ones, though, handle and I know you're an attorney, not a psychiatrist.
My dad's a psychiatrist. But, so is my brother.
Oh, there you go then. Then you're qualified in my book. How does one go about caring for, like in Susan's case, her family cared, loved her, you know, tried to talk to her. But when the likes of the Josh Powells of the world then keep you from seeing your children and your grandchildren because now you've posed a threat because you're trying to talk, you know, their spouse into a different direction. How does a family decide when it's time to take that risk of never seeing your loved ones again?
I think, you know, every case is different, but this was one that had the family intervened, you know, and just got there with the kids. That could have worked. But because she was so far gone, she was ready to divorce. But I think if you're not at that point, if, you know, the person that you care about, this potential victim, is not at that point, then it's just going to have to be that talking people through, you know, that you care about them, that you'd like to help them get out, et cetera. And that's a process. I've done it within my own family with my sister years ago in a situation where I wanted to see her do happier and doing something else. And she looks back now and says, yeeks, you know, what was I thinking? And I think those are things that you help people get to that, you know, decision that they should have made, but maybe they're too conflicted to make it and too paralyzed because of support issues, you know, having children and just the responsibilities of day-to-day life.
It definitely is a hard decision.
Well, and sometimes you need to deal with the police. I mean, we look at any of these cases. Like, if you look at Nicole Simpson, I just use that because everybody knows that case, not because it's, you know, one that comes to mind on these issues, but everyone knows those facts. What if she had gone and stuck with going with the police and her family had come in and said, you're not going to be around him anymore, you're not going to, you know, interface with him, you're not going to do this, you're not going to do that. You know, that could have stopped all of it. You know, at least for a while before, so he could kind of cool down and not be as, you know, obsessed as he was at that time. You know, sometimes you just need to deal with, I think, law enforcement and just that clean break, at least for a while.
Since you brought up the dear old O.J. Simpson case, do you think that with everything that we've been seeing, and you know, we hope to see you in January at the trafficking conference here in Portland.
I'd love that.
With everything
I'm looking forward to that. You guys do a great job.
Wonderful, wonderful. With everything that we've been seeing lately, from Lawrence Taylor to Charlie Sheen, to OJ, you know, all of these big name folks, and we'll be having the victim of James Brown on in the coming weeks.
Good.
Yeah, so she'll be speaking up. And do you think that we should be in a place in society where it takes us 20, 30 years to be able to finally talk about people? And like in James Brown's case, once he's dead, now I feel safe enough to talk. Do you think we're in a place in America where we should be able to say, I don't care that you're a celebrity, you know, enough is enough? Because it seems as if lately the celebrities get a pat on the wrist, whereas anybody else, you know, if we get pulled over or we get arrested or, you know, we'd be serving time like the Amanda Knoxes of the world, where other people, where all the evidence led to OJ, and yet he got off.
Exactly. And then look at Charlie Sheen. I mean, not only did he have his whole incident in Colorado, you know, where he tried to, did he try to strangle his wife, Brooke Mueller, I think?
Yep.
And then you had his, all of his other issues in Los Angeles, and then you end up with this trashing of a room in New York and at the Plaza Hotel.
And don't forget Heidi Fleiss. I mean, he was
I was thinking about LA, Heidi Fleiss, right. You know, here's this guy, and he's always, you know, they always say he's like on coke or, you know, he's doing all these different things. And he just glides on back, you know, and they say, and I read a poll that said, you know, how come Lindsay Lohan is demonized and Charlie Sheen just waltzes back to work. And it's kind of like, that was interesting too on the standard between men and women in that industry, that he can be just the bad boy that everyone loves and make more money than God in Hollywood. And, you know, it seems like nothing will ever stick to him. Never. I mean, if he can strangle his wife, you know, and then he can, like, you know, trash this room, trash, you know, everything in there, have coke all over the place, be buck naked, have the cops come in, the gal's locked in the closet because she's afraid of him, and he tore her handbag apart, who knows if he laid a hand on her, no charges. Nothing. You know, he flies home. So, and O.J. Simpson, I mean, all these celebrities, it doesn't set a good example for the rest of us. Because if they're walking all over the place, you know, the people that are so public that should be an example, you know, why should anybody follow what they do?
Exactly.
Or they can follow what they do, but they're going to go to jail. If you're just, you know, the man on the street, the little guy, the every man, the every woman.
Yeah, it just seems as if recently, you know, we've always had the issues, but just this past year, it just seems like celebrity after celebrity having their issues. And yet, when you look at society, we all make mistakes. We all have accidents and fender benders.
Mm-hmm.
Not too many of us have lost our Mercedes over at the Hollywood Hills twice, but, you know, we continue to, you know, that's living, you know, and you learn from your mistakes and you move on. But it just seems as if they just feel like they're untouchable. And obviously when studios slap you with an $8 million a week paycheck, it shows that it's okay to screw up in the public eye, you know.
Well,
and so I was just curious from an attorney standpoint.
Well, I think, you know, that old saying that the only bad publicity is no publicity. Paris Hilton, you know, she's had her brushes with the law, and I've seen it written in some of the tabloids, at least, saying that she needed attention because she wasn't being played up as much as Kim Kardashian. So one way is to get busted, you know, and then you're all over the news again. And that was true, of course, for Lindsay Lohan. And, I mean, sometimes you're just in the news for being in trouble. But it's something that's so appalling, you know, when we look at who are the idols in our society. And I agree with you, Charlie Sheen. I mean, you know, he's just an unguided missile. I mean, he may end up dead, but it's in a blaze of glory as far as everyone seems to be concerned.
And how
just
many women, you know, need to be victims? This is what, his second or third marriage? And, you know, you know, there's been many charges. And we're not trying to go off on a tangent with celebrities for the listeners listening in. We're trying to understand in how often do we need to re-victimize the victims. And we don't know the circumstances. And if she gets $12,000 a night with him or whatever, if she was abused, she's still a victim. And so are the wives and anybody else for that matter, like in the Lawrence Taylor case, that young girl was a runaway. And she was a victim, and the media re-victimized her over and over again. So
over and over again, yeah.
Over and over again. And that actually, we started, through Seroptimus, we started the Jane Velez Mitchell Journalism Award. So the committee is out, you know, selecting the honoree for this year. But it's important that we take a stand with the media. And you mentioned media a few times. They can be your friend or foe. And in the end, you know, we want to make sure that victims of, you know, abuse or victims of trafficking, victims of kidnappings, et cetera, remain the victim. You know, and I think when we as a society can continue seeing it that way, Amanda Knox is a victim of the system. I believe that truly. And so, and I will stick with that because I'm a firm believer, show me the evidence, show me the DNA, and then I will shut up. But
show me the motive.
You can't pull off a perfect crime. A teenager,
right.
A young kid cannot pull off a perfect crime. And we'll see that in other cases throughout the time. But in the end, show us the evidence. But when you have a victim, we need to listen to them. And in Susan Powell's case, there's three victims besides Susan, her family, and those two boys.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to start listening to people. There's another question, anyone who loses, it's a laugh out loud kind of thing. Anyone who loses their Mercedes over Hollywood Hills twice is not learning from their mistakes.
That's great.
But that $8 million paycheck could definitely get you a new one right away. So
That's a great comment.
Yeah, I like this person who's in the chat room. Funny person.
Mm-hmm.
We have 4 minutes left. Anything that you want to talk? Any other cases going on? When will the listeners be able to see you again on Nancy or Jane?
Oh, I'm coming out. I've got my dates for my website. I always forget, but I was just on Nancy couple nights ago, and you know, I covered the Michael Jackson case with Jane. I was with her for 6 months. I just wanted to say that I have never seen a person more attentive or more into a case than Jane Velez Mitchell. So that everyone that loves her and watches her, and now you've got an award named for her, she is the most prepared, interested, dogged reporter ever, long before she got her show and everything else. So she was really a joy to work with and always curious and completely into it and had lots of legal questions all the time. So that was great. But I think some Nancy and some Jane, and I think I like to see what you're doing with Voices for Justice and Victims, and just like Nancy and Jane do with these cases where we have victims that need attention, they need justice, and they need to be found. But the only thing I wanted to say is I just wonder why so often they're women and children, and how frustrating that is, that the more defenseless part, you know, of our society, parts of our society are the ones that we talk about on these shows over and over and over again. And I think I applaud you for believing in Amanda Knox, but for everything that you do with your show and your conference and now you've done with that award, because there are people that are forgotten or can be forgotten if people don't talk about them over and over. You know, Susan went missing December 9th. So it's going to be a year, December 9th, that no one knows where she is. Her parents, you know, are heartbroken, and her boys are confused. They've been pulled up all kinds of different stories about where their mom is. And now they're being told in the papers that she ran off sexually promiscuous, that she didn't want to be there. And I just hope that there's justice in her case, and I hope it's
And there's no telling what he's doing, and his father, which is no better. What they're telling those boys over and over again. So our hearts and prayers definitely go out to them. One last question in the chat room. Ask Anne, when does the stats run out to prosecute your abuser?
So on a civil case?
On the statute of limitations run out to prosecute your abuser.
Well, that's a complicated.
And I know that.
Go ahead. No, it's a little complicated because we have the discovery rule in most states that says that the statute runs from the time, if you were a child victim, runs from the time that you discover the impact of the abuse on you. But it's generally a 3-year statute.
I hope that answered your question, Deborah, in the chat room. Thank you, Anne. Thank you so very much.
Well, thanks for having me. And on the statute of limitations, it can be 7, it could be longer, it just depends on your jurisdiction. But the key is discovering the impact on you, which you may never discover, so you could have kind of an endless statute. How bad
that answer,
is.
Deborah says yes, that answered her question.
Okay, good, okay.
And I
Thank
believe
you.
If that's the same Deborah Brown, she'll be on our show December 10th, so join us then. Thank you to all of our listeners, and again, thanks, Anne, so much, and for all that you do. I know that you're having a voice for many people here in Washington, but I know that you have a voice – throughout the week also when you're on the air and talking the Amanda Knox or Susan's case to the viewers of Nancy and Jane. So thank you so much.
I was honored. Thank you.
Thank you. And our next show is Wednesday, 6 to 7 Pacific time, November 17th. We sit down with a family whose life took a horrible detour on, and that will be Shelby's story. And if you'd like to join us, again, that's Wednesday, November 17th, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific time. And I'll leave you with this thought again. Everyone can be a voice for justice. What will you do this week to make a difference? Be the change you wish to see in the world. I wish all of the veterans a happy Veterans Day tomorrow, and our prayers go out to our men and women that are fighting a good fight for us to be free here in America. And I apologize again for the intro delay, but thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next week. Good night.
Anybody out there really care?